Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. One Virginia man spreads the gospel of green.
We can, retrain coal miners to become energy efficiency specialists.
There are fireflies in Pennsylvania that blink together.
The fireflies are a paradigm of this larger theme of nature organizing itself.
More women are taking on the role of farmer.
Dad's getting older, and if I wanted an opportunity to work with him and learn from him, I needed to do that.
A Tennessee writer has fond memories of hunting frogs.
That was my assignment, circling strange ponds for hours late at night, blinding amphibians.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. Educators from all over the country are currently in Denver, Colorado at the 152nd annual meeting of the National Education Association. West Virginia Education Association President Dale Lee is there for discussions on issues like the Common Core standards and standardized testing. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board spoke with Lee before he left and has this report.
Improving education is going to take more investment to effectively implement, and it will take time to see the fruits of those labors. Those are two major thoughts that the state's Education Association President Dale Lee offered when reflecting on the state of public education in West Virginia.
I think we're moving in the right direction. Our graduation rate is on the rise, which is a positive for West Virginia. West Virginia now has more than 750 nationally board certified teachers.
There's been mounting concern throughout the state, as well as the country, over the efficacy of standardized testing. Lee reports that teachers are increasingly frustrated with test-driven curriculum.
We're just testing kids to death, and teachers need the time to teach. To have everything based on a single test score is just the wrong way for an education system.
Another topic of discussion at the National Education Association's meeting will be the Common Core standards, a newer wave of education benchmarks for English and language arts and math adopted by 43 states and the District of Columbia, four territories, and the Defense Department. The National Governors Association led the effort to create the standards in an effort to provide a clear, consistent understanding of what students are expected to learn. The standards aim to align schools in preparing students with the knowledge and skills required for successful entry into college and careers. West Virginia has already begun implementing the standards.
As I've traveled around the state, one of the complaints that I've heard is that we haven't done a good job of giving the proper training to implement the Common Core, or the time and resources to do it and do it correctly. For example, there are many times that you have to do a lot of outside activities to prepare the lesson. You have to do some project-based learning and those types of things. And we haven't built additional time for teachers or additional resources for the materials to do that.
Lee says next year, testing will begin to evaluate how well students are learning the new standards, but he stresses that test scores won't be a reliable reflection of student achievement until they're taken by kids who have had several years of experience with the new standards. He says reliable data could take 4 to 8 years to see. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glennis Board in Morgantown.
The best West Virginia 8th graders in social studies and arts from various counties had some fun recently, spending a week learning about the state's history. One of the events was a scavenger hunt. West Virginia Public Radio's Liz McCormick has more.
Okay, you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go.
Okay, guys, back here.
Summer Street's back there.
Have fun!
That's one of seven groups of 8th graders participating in the West Virginia Ambassadors Camp's annual scavenger hunt. The search began at Davis Park, and they searched for 16 locations on their scavenger hunt list.
Have you guys found anything else?
I'm a little man up there.
Oh. Very good.
Tim Brady with the Charleston Convention and Visitors Bureau hosted the scavenger hunt for about 70 students.
We've designed this photo scavenger hunt to lead teams strategically throughout the city so that they can see some of what Charleston has to offer, some of the architecture of the city, some of the parks and recreation offerings that we have. So it's our way of giving these kids an urban experience and then using a tool to get them out into the city so that they can see what Charleston has to offer.
Each group was given a paper, one side with a map of downtown Charleston, and the other side with pictures and clues. Matthew Austin, one of the coordinators with the Convention and Visitors Bureau, says that the kids have a blast with the scavenger hunt.
Kids don't say it, but they like to be outside. They like, I mean, I think that's just a human nature to want to be outside, to want to do fun things. So it kind of engages them to be outside, be active. And I think that's something that we really need, period, in the world today.
Well, you guys are the first group back, so
that's because we're awesome like that.
Group 7 found 15 out of 16. We've already checked their answers, and they were right.
The winning team of this year's scavenger hunt won restaurant gift cards and the respect of their peers as knowing the most about Charleston. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Charleston.
Meanwhile, there's sports-related news in higher education this week. The University of Kentucky Athletics is entering into a $210 million multimedia marketing rights agreement with JMI Sports. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, the 15-year agreement is being called one of the most valuable partnerships of its kind.
UK Executive Vice President Eric Munday says the marketing alliance is a financial win for both JMI and UK Athletics.
JMI Sports represents the university, and athletics goes out, builds relationships, builds the radio network, puts corporate sponsorships together and other things. They receive revenue from those corporate entities for those rights, and then they utilize that to pay their commitment back to the institution.
Munday says campus multimedia rights could mean more revenue, employment opportunities, and student internships. UK Athletics Director Mitch Barnhart was asked if this $200-plus million agreement could have any bearing on the Rupp Arena project or building an on-campus basketball arena.
This is not about the Rupp Arena piece. This is about our sustainability and working our, making sure that operationally and resource-wise, we have the ability to look to the future and keep our program where we are competitively, where we are academically, what our kids are doing away from the game.
The contract with JMI covers everything from radio rights and stadium and arena corporate signage to coaches' endorsements and game sponsorships. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
Some decisions by West Virginia University's athletic department to spend money upgrading sports facilities were criticized a few weeks ago by a WVU professor. In an essay on Inside Appalachia, visiting law professor Michael Blumenthal questioned the wisdom of fixing up the football stadium when there are so many academic-related needs on the Morgantown campus. But WVU athletic director Oliver Luck argues that academics will actually benefit if money is spent on athletics.
There is another point of view as to whether West Virginia University should spend millions of dollars to fix up its football stadium than the one expressed by visiting law professor Michael Blumenthal in his essay for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Inside Appalachia. Professor Blumenthal questions whether such an outlay is appropriate for an institution of higher learning. Needless to say, as athletic director at West Virginia University, I believe it is, and for reasons that are both practical and educational. Addressing education first, there is no argument that West Virginia University's first responsibility is to provide the best and broadest educational experience possible for its students. It is the first part of our land-grant mission of teaching, research, and service. For many current and potential students, high-quality intercollegiate athletics are a key part of that experience. Successful athletic programs also provide an important touchstone for alumni and help keep them connected to their alma mater, a connection which can result in increased support for the academic mission. And high-profile athletic programs provide a platform and audience the university can use to draw attention to the stellar economics of the institution. But being successful requires first-rate facilities, and that is where the practical side comes in. Just within the past couple of weeks, our department announced investments of more than $100 million to renovate specific areas at Milan Puskar Stadium, the Coliseum, and the Shell Building. This money will come from $75 million in bonds and $25 million from private philanthropy. All three structures are in an age where renovation and upgrades are required. The Coliseum is 44 years old, the football stadium 34 years old, and the Shell Building 33 years old. We plan to take advantage of the imminent departure of the College of Physical Activity and Sports Science to its own new building on the Evansdale campus this fall to renovate the Coliseum and Shell Building, which, by the way, have essentially been untouched since they were both built. We also plan a number of other smaller projects, such as the new locker room at the Lesk Soccer Stadium and repurposing the existing baseball park, Holly Field. Historically, WVU has maintained its facilities extraordinarily well, and I give kudos to both the facilities department as well as our athletic department employees for their good work over the years. However, there comes a time when modernization is called for, and that time is now. It would be negligent on our part to not invest significantly in renovating and upgrading our athletic infrastructure, particularly given that athletics is a self-sufficient auxiliary unit. We'll be able to pay for these improvements in large part due to the guaranteed payments we will receive during the next decade from both the Big 12 Conference and IMG College. These payments are substantially higher than in years past. These projects have been fully vetted, reviewed, and approved by a number of different groups, all of whom have some oversight responsibility for the complete mission of WVU. Those groups include the West Virginia University Planning Committee, the West Virginia University Board of Governors, as well as the West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission. They all studied our mid- and long-term revenue and expense projections and determined that we were on solid ground with our plans to repay the bond. It is also important to remember that while the athletic department is an integral part of the university experience, it is a self-supporting auxiliary unit and, as such, does not pull funding from the university's core mission. All these costs are funded from athletic department-generated revenues. Significant capital expenditures are taking place all over Morgantown and Monongahela County, not all of which are directly tied to the university. That is just one of the reasons it is such a vibrant and dynamic community. And we would be shirking our duty as a part of that vibrant and dynamic community to do anything less than provide the best athletic program possible, and that means keeping our facilities in first-rate shape.
Coming up inside Appalachia, a Virginia coal miner preaches the gospel of green. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. 110 high school students from around the world just took part in a week-long event in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, that encourages them to develop conservation leadership skills. The Student Climate and Conservation Conference, which is called SC3 for short, asked the question, how are we as global citizens going to bring back and contribute to our schools and communities? Students representing 30 states and 9 countries, including Brazil, France, and Somalia, attended the event, which is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Green Schools Alliance. The students are tasked with going back to their communities with a plan of action.
My name is Megan Cooper. I am from Matamoros, PA, and I go to the Darrow School in New Lebanon, New York. Through the networking group and through what I know in my school that I already has, I really will be working with awareness. And my school's kids from all different, total different backgrounds. So I'm going to be working on just bringing people together and realizing what we do have and where we can go from that. I haven't decided where that will be yet or anything, but just bringing all this knowledge together, the knowledge is basically what will bring us further.
My name is Jared Buxton. I live in Birmingham, Alabama, and I go to Oak Mountain High School, Meadowbrook. Well, I'm definitely going to start by trying to get my school to join the Green Schools Alliance. Also going to try to work with this group called the Alabama Environmental Council. So I tell them about SC3 and how I want them to work with my school and just apply what I learned here.
My name is Zach Shulkin. I am the founder and president of the Environmental Conservation Club at my school. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and I go to Memphis University School. The reason that I came here was to bring back new knowledge for ways that I could help my club and also the school. And I also learned many new ways, actually, that I can improve my school to make it greener, such as I had thought before, because my school actually contracts with this cafeteria company called Sodexo. I had originally thought that they only provided styrofoam plates, but I was talking about that, and one of the guys who I'm working with said that his school actually also contracts with Sodexo, and he said that they are willing and able to provide different things like paper plates or plastic to prevent all the waste that has been caused by my school.
What made you want to come to this?
Well, one of the faculty members of my school had approached me because I am the founder and president of the Environmental Conservation Club at my school.
Well, it's my third year here, SC3, and it's a great place for networking, meeting new people all over the country. You know, a lot of different people, a lot of great people. And it's just a great place to find ideas, to bounce your ideas off other people. You know, there's never any stupid questions or anything. You can just be yourself, you know, try to figure out things to bring back to your community, and it's just a great place to be.
What do you think drives you to want to do this, though?
I guess my passion is just to conserve, you know, use the resources that we have and everything.
I'm here because my school is part of the Green Schools Alliance, and I heard about it online, and I figured this is such a great opportunity. How could I resist from coming here? I see the world as opportunities, and if you're ignorant of those, then you're just setting yourself up for failure. So,
Susie Marvin is a public school teacher from Leslie County, Kentucky, who is a faculty member teaching during the SC3 conference. Like the students, Marvin plans to implement some of what she's learning here.
I think one major thing I'll be bringing back is a lot of really practical ideas for the classroom. The faculty at SC3, a lot of them have been teachers for many, many years, and I'm a pretty fresh teacher. I just finished my first year of teaching, so I'll be bringing back a lot of great ideas from the students and the faculty as well to use in my classroom.
Do you have an example or two?
So the group that I'm helping facilitate here is the Sustainable Agriculture Group, talking about what we can do to provide fresh food to people who have a difficult time accessing that, and how we can make our agricultural practices more sustainable. And one way that I hope to do that in my school in the future is we've got this great little greenhouse out back, and the kids last year expressed interest in starting the greenhouse project up. So in talking with people at the conference, I've been able to get some ideas on how we could really help that project to take root at our school.
The first SC3 took place in 2009, and since then, 700 students have graduated from it. One former coal miner in Virginia is already taking action on conservation issues. Summer was historically a time for itinerant preachers to travel the country, saving souls at tent revivals. Today, a not-for-profit called Appalachian Voices is following in that tradition, putting a fourth-generation coal miner on the road to preach the gospel of green energy. WVTF Sandy Hausman has this look at Nick Mullen's crusade.
Like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, Nick Mullins took a job mining coal. He had a wife and two kids to support, and the money was good.
Equipment operators were making $22 to $23 an hour. Electricians, which is the job I performed, were making $28 an hour.
But his father was disabled by the work, suffering long-term back pain. And as Mullins saw the impact of mountaintop removal around Clintwood, Virginia, he had second thoughts about the business.
I just realized, you know, there's got to be more to life than to going into the same dark places and wearing out your body.
And with cheap supplies of natural gas flooding the energy marketplace, he had doubts about how long a job in mining might last. He'd heard about a small liberal arts school in Kentucky that did not charge tuition. Students accepted there got a free education in exchange for doing jobs on campus, so he and his wife applied and were accepted. At Berea College, they learned more about the environment and ways of living sustainably. They started thinking about farming.
Yeah, we'd like to eventually settle down and have a farm. We love to garden. Rusty, my wife, works at the college gardens for her labor position. She loves getting her hands in the dirt, and I do too. But we also realize that there's a lot of important work, so our garden is currently being overtaken by weeds.
That important work, in Nick's view, was preaching the gospel of green energy.
It's really important that people understand where their energy comes from and that there are alternatives, not just in the renewable energies, but energy efficiency. As much energy as we waste, we can be conserving that and reducing our need for fossil fuels such as coal.
He connected with a not-for-profit called Appalachian Voices, and this summer they put him on the road, traveling from Mississippi to New England, Champaign-Urbana to Asheville, covering 3,800 miles in 45 days, talking about how coal miners should be trained to play a whole new role in our economy.
There is a lot of money out there that's available in coal severance taxes, as well as the Department of Labor, that we can, you know, retrain coal miners to become energy efficiency specialists, since coal miners are intelligent, wonderful people with a lot of pride and heritage in doing what's best for the next generation.
And in the Mullins family, the next generation agrees, feeling proud to take part in the tour.
My name is Alexandria Mullins. I am 9 years old.
I'm Danny Mullins. I'm 12 years old, and I'm from Bury, Kentucky right now, but I'm originally from Clintwood, Virginia, which is where my family lived for 10 generations.
They echo their parents' concerns.
We are standing up for all these generations to come and also to make coal mining stop.
It doesn't matter what type of coal mining you do, something wrong still happens, like the Inez disaster.
The rivers are always turned orange because the coal and all the other soils are like a natural filter for the water.
And whenever you blast off the top of the mountain and push it over into the valley, it turns into a giant filter of death.
Near our spring, there was a turtle cell. No turtle in it. I knew straight away that a turtle had drank from the water and died.
And neither aspires to work in a mine. Alexandria vows to be an artist and an activist, while her brother says he's ready to join the movement away from coal. I'm Sandy Houseman.
While Nick Mullins and his wife have talked about farming eventually, the growing season is well underway for many farmers. Women have helped on the farms for generations, but now they're beginning to take ownership of their duties, calling themselves farmers instead of just farmers' wives. The USDA has found a steady increase of women farmers in the 2000s, which plateaued in the agency's latest five-year report. Whitney Jones of WKMS visits a Trigg County, Kentucky farm where one daughter is showing that farm work isn't just for men.
It's a rainy day at Riverbend Farms. The fields are muddy, but that doesn't keep Alana Baker from her work.
We just got done planting early beans. We've been side dressing corn.
Earlier, she attended the cattle with her father and has a page-long to-do list next to her in the pickup truck she drives around the 5,000 acres her family farms. Baker never thought she'd come home to farm, but while working as a fundraiser for the American Cancer Society nearly 2 years ago, she says she woke up and just knew it was time. What she didn't know that day was that her decision then would mean so much more in the coming year.
Dad's getting older, and if I wanted an opportunity to work with him and learn from him, I needed to do that while I didn't have kids, while I wasn't married. It's worked out well because we found out in January Dad's got cancer. If I hadn't been here for a year before that, it'd have been way too much to come home and just jump right into.
Baker's father is the main operator, but she's taking on many of those responsibilities since he's become ill. Baker now runs the farm when he's away on treatments. Since she grew up in the farming community, she says she hasn't faced too many setbacks as a woman in the once male-dominated industry. But on occasion, she's had to assert that she's the one to do business with for Riverbend Farms.
The only obstacles I really face are with people that we don't know. So, you know, sometimes like seed salesmen, they want to talk to the male of the operation, and like, well, there's not one. You have to talk to me.
Samantha Anderson is also a farmer's daughter. She's studying at Murray State and working to eventually run her family's tobacco crop and cattle farm in central Kentucky. Like Baker, she says she hasn't experienced much discrimination as a woman farmer. What she has seen, though, is women becoming more and more involved in agriculture.
Even if you look like at the gender spread within the FFA, the girls are taking over. That's not necessarily saying that more girls are going back to the farm, but within the broad field of agriculture in general, girls are making a really big impact.
Women made up about 14% of farm operators in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's 2007 and 2012 census. Compare that to numbers from 30 years ago. In 1982, not even a full percentage point of operators were women. Both the USDA and Murray State sociology professor Scott Bird say part of that is the rise of the small farm. Most women farmers run operations much smaller than those Anderson and Baker go home to.
A lot of women, they're turning back to the land. They're going back and self-identifying as farmers for various reasons. Maybe they want to be involved in more sustainable practices for their family and their local community. Maybe they're involved in food justice. A lot of those farms are smaller farms.
Bird says more women also inherit farmland now, where previously it went to male family members. Other factors leading women to self-identify as farmers include increased technology. Decades ago, most women just did not have the physical strength required for farm work. Now there are tools that make that work easier. Back at Riverbend Farms, Baker watches as a farmhand cleans a tractor with a large sprayer. She says she's going to send their handful of workers home early since a rainy day is a welcome rest during the busy planting season. Inside the home her family has lived in for generations, Baker's father Stan rests. He's glad she's around.
Always kind of hoped that someday she might want to come back because there's really nobody else to take the farm and run with it, you know, like it needs to be.
Baker says her skills, some of which she admits are stereotypically feminine, have already helped bring the farm forward. She's organized and keeps lists along with a database of what's been planted so her family can keep track of what methods are best. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Whitney Jones.
Well, the other night at dusk, I sat on my patio eating ice cream, watching the fireflies float up from the grass. They were a twinkling ornamentation to a perfect summer evening. The fireflies in my yard blink randomly, but there's a place in Pennsylvania where the flash of the lightning bugs presents a well-orchestrated display. They blink in sync. 2 summers ago, the Allegheny Friends' Ann Murray went to the Allegheny National Forest to check it out.
Ken Butler and his wife Peggy own a bed and breakfast near a big discovery. Fireflies that flash in sync have been found across the road from them. Right now, scientists think synchronous fireflies are only found in pockets of the Appalachian Mountains and in Southeast Asia. The Butlers have been taking guests to see the light show in their neck of the Allegheny Forest.
It's like a natural fireworks show. Ooh, ah.
Ken says the forest really is lovely, dark, and deep, so he suggests we head to the location where the synchronous fireflies were first spotted.
Well, shall we go up to the famous Camp 11?
Yeah.
We walk deeper into the woods along a trail that follows Branch Creek. The canopy of spruce, oak, and hemlock blocks out most of the moonlight. About a quarter of a mile into the woods, Ken shines his flashlight on a landmark boulder in the National Forest campsite.
This is it right here. There's the famous Sitting Rock.
Ken turns off his light and we stand motionless in the dark. At first we see a few random male fireflies flashing. Then the choreographed blinking happens all around us. Oh, there they are in sync. Clusters of fireflies fly about 4 feet off the ground and light up the brush with their luminous tails. They all flash 5 or 6 times together and then stop for about 10 seconds. Then they flash in unison again, and the forest returns to darkness while they recharge the biochemicals that allow them to glow.
Some that are really strobe light over here now. Oh, look at that.
Peggy claps her hands to demonstrate how the fireflies can start and stay in unison for several hours at a time.
If you clap your hands once and say, everybody clap with me, but you only clap once, it's really hard to synchronize that. But if I say, everybody clap with me, and I clap multiple times, by the second or third time I clap, everybody can be in synchrony with me.
Peggy picked up this insight from Lynn Faust. Faust came to the Allegheny National Forest with an international team of firefly researchers. They logged lots of late-night hours in the forest observing this synchronous population and studying them at their makeshift lab in Peggy's garage. Faust has studied the life cycle of synchronous fireflies in the Great Smoky Mountains for 20 years. She says the all-male light display is basically a sexual competition.
I used to get the impression I was watching teenage boys revving their engines driving down the road. They're all about the females, but they're also competing with themselves.
While the guys show off, females hang out in the grass or low tree branches. Just like other species of fireflies, the females recognize their male's specific flash pattern. If they're interested, they blink back. The males then drop out of the air like little shooting stars to try to mate.
They're quite desperate, and you can appreciate their desperation to find that mate and get their life cycle completed to assure the next generation.
These little insects symbolize something bigger. It seems nature wants to be in sync. Steve Strogatz at Cornell University writes about synchronized fireflies as an example of natural organization. He says this drive exists in everything from human cells to planets.
The fireflies are a paradigm of this larger theme of nature organizing itself. It's really the subject for the whole 21st century. We're trying to understand collective behavior, and that's the big mystery for almost all sciences out there today.
Peggy and Ken Butler both agree that the science behind the synchronous fireflies is fascinating, but they think the fireflies' light display also signals something else.
It is really about just taking the time to relax and watch nature and, you know, observe and behold what is happening around you.
Thousands of people go to the Smoky Mountains to watch the synchronous fireflies there. Peggy and Ken hope with the right planning, the Allegheny Forest will become a firefly destination, too. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Murray.
The Allegheny Front is a weekly public radio show focused on environmental issues in Pennsylvania and the surrounding region. Up next inside Appalachia, getting out of the heat on a hot summer day and frog hunting. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. As summer heats up, at least one spot in Pennsylvania is still as cold as winter. A roadside tourist attraction and natural wonder, the Countersport Ice Mine in Potter County is open again after 25 years. Here's the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel.
On Ice Mountain, part of the Appalachians in north-central Pennsylvania, at the top of Ice Mine Road, $4 will get you one admission into something a little different from the campsites and hiking trails around here.
Hi, just Hi. One, please.
Alrighty.
A lot of folklore is attached to the Countersport Ice Mine, including the rumor that it's man-made. That's because some people, even people who live here, can't believe that the ice inside the ice mine only forms here during the summertime. But 19-year-old Jeff McManus is a believer. He's giving tours today.
I've lived here my whole life. My dad was a tour guide in the 70s, and my grandma worked in the gift shop in the 50s.
The site's been closed longer than he's been alive, but it's just reopened under new management. McManus says he couldn't wait to work here. He opens the lock on a weathered door with a shiny new key.
Are we all gonna fit?
Oh yeah, you can all fit. Go right on in.
Whoa, it is cold.
What did you expect here?
Freezing in here.
This is what I remember last time being here.
Kevin and Patty Staffa are visiting with family from New Jersey. They were here once before it closed. It's 32 degrees behind the door, like walking into a refrigerator. A small group of people at a time can stand around a wooden platform and lean over the metal railing, which surrounds the opening into the earth. It's really just an 8 by 10 feet pit, a cave a few dozen feet deep. Below, there are icicles, like elephant tusks, clinging to the sides of the mine.
There's about 18 inches of ice right now on the bottom.
All around the opening are layers of rocks, covered in moss and dripping with water. It's a small dungeon-like room that's open at the top. It wouldn't look out of place on the set of a Lord of the Rings film. Looking up, you see clouds and old hemlock trees swaying in the breeze.
They think that during the winter the air is pushed into the mountain because the rocks are layered like this through the whole mountain, and then in the summer the air comes out, mixes with the humidity and the heat, forming the ice.
You can feel it if you put your hand up to the tower of rocks.
It's right here, cold, very cold.
Yep. Oh yeah, feeling cold today, isn't it? That's pretty cool.
The bigger icicles are under there. You can kind of see them.
The hotter it is outside, the more ice forms.
A few weeks ago, there was ice around the whole entire thing, touching the bottom. But because it's been colder weather and we've had all this rain, it's broken down inside.
The mine was found by a silver prospector in 1894. It was used to store meat, and the ice was harvested. Then it was turned into a tourist attraction in the early 1900s. This ice mine is one of many so-called cold spots from southern New York to West Virginia in these mountains. Outside the mine on the patio, Diana Buxton is greeting guests.
Hello. You go right on in. Hi.
Buxton and her husband, Gary, own a nearby inn and bought the old ice mine about a year ago. They've restored it, down to putting in begonias similar to the ones planted here during its heyday. Buxton says the ice mine is never going to be Niagara Falls or an amusement park. She wants visitors to experience something else here.
I just hope they take that quietness and peacefulness and stress-free lifestyle that we're hoping to promote up here.
So far, hundreds have come to take a peek at the ice and sign the guest book from as far away as Germany. Buxton's cousin, Chris Herzig, didn't travel as far. She's from right here in Countersport, and she's been to the mine many times over the years. But she has a new idea to promote it.
Those of us that are of a certain age that have hot flashes, I think there should be a special ticket that you can go in and out as many times as needed for medicinal purposes.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holsapple.
For Fred Sossman, a favorite warm weather pastime was hunting for frogs, something he did with his father each year.
I don't hear much talk of frog hunting anymore. Biologists say the frog population is declining worldwide, an ominous sign for the planet and its ecosystems. And the conditions under which my father and I hunted frogs in the 1960s would be today dangerous, if not possibly fatal. Back then, my father thought nothing about showing up in the middle of the night, unannounced, on the banks of someone's farm pond in rural Greene County, Tennessee. The Magnavox Company, where he worked, employed about 6,000 people in the 1960s, and my father knew just about all of them. Many of his co-workers lived out in the county, and they had ponds. My father never felt it necessary to call ahead or even go up to an owner's house, knock on the door, and announce our presence. Yet we were never confronted, accosted, or fired upon. Think of it. Two truck headlights scan the fields, a lit cigarette is traceable from truck to pond, a flashlight draws patterns on the water's surface and, if my attention lapses, on the clouds above. Despite the light show, nobody gets suspicious. We completed these hunts without interruptions from any anxious landowners ever. Grasping a cane pole with a gig attached, my father would tiptoe around the water's edge while I held the flashlight and a cotton sack. That was my assignment, circling strange ponds for hours late at night, blinding amphibians. When my beam of light met two eyes just above the water line, my father, rocking back on one foot like a javelin thrower, would spear the frog with that gig. Primitive, perhaps, but the alternative was rifle fire, .22 caliber hollow-point bullets. They greatly increased your range, certainly, but wading into the cold, dark, snaky water without the luxury of hip boots to try and retrieve the frog negated the advantage. Most every hardware store carried frog gigs in those days. They consisted of four barbed prongs. A good supply of cane poles always stood in the corner of our garage. We made teepee structures out of them for beans to climb on in the summertime, and they were my fishing poles. There were no mechanical parts on my childhood fishing gear, no reels, no line entanglement, not much casting, really. Cane poles were versatile tools at our house. Toward midnight, when the cotton sack got so heavy and so jumpy with frogs that I could barely carry it, we'd head back home, and my father would clean the frogs in the backyard. The implements were always the same: a block of concrete, a yellow case pocket knife, a pair of pliers, and a pan of water. In 2009, for a special foodways issue, the staff at the University of North Carolina's Southern Cultures magazine asked me to write a short piece about my favorite food. I contemplated country ham, fried chicken, rice with gravy, oysters, and soup beans. But as much for the memory as for the taste, I settled on fresh frog legs. Freeze them, and the flavor, texture, and color are lost. Fresh out of the pond, they are ethereal. The morning after those frog hunts, my mother would roll the legs in salted and peppered flour and fry them lightly in a black iron skillet. The cotton-white meat is still my favorite food. The recollection of it made all the more poignant because these trips into the night were cut short too early by my father's untimely death in the winter of 1973. I haven't frog hunted since. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Fred Sossman.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Teenagers Nevada and Riley Tribble and Walter King have been going to shows at the Augusta Heritage Center in Elkins for years. One of their mentors, Gary Milnes, says the three are among the youngest musicians to ever take classes at Augusta. And although they mostly play old-time tunes, the Alley Cats also cover a few contemporary songs, like this one by the Avett Brothers. The Alley Cats began playing this song shortly before their fourth bandmate, Gene Boyer, sadly passed away last May. Roxy Todd sat down with the three musicians to talk about the band that Boyer helped them create.
The Tribbles' house stands out from the street because of the solar panels on the roof. And because even from outside, you can hear the sound of 16-year-old Walter King warming up his fiddle. Beside him stands Nevada Tribble, with long, straight red hair and her banjo resting upright on the couch. She's about to turn 17 and is the Alley Cat's oldest musician. Her 14-year-old brother, Riley Tribble, plays the mandolin and upright bass. His bass is golden yellow and, as Riley explains, has a special significance for the Alley Cats.
Yeah, Gene lived just across the alley, and he originally played the bass, and I actually play his bass right now because I got it after he passed away. I picked up the bass and started playing after an Augusta class. He played with us the first day that we played. It was like in the winter, and we went in our garage back there, so.
And we just decided to like play a tune together to see if it would work. And it was fun, so we decided to make a band. Gene got us our first gig at the Pickens Maple Syrup Festival. And we just drove up there and played for an hour.
The three young musicians learned to play music by ear, mostly by soaking up the vibrant music scene that hovers around Elkins during the summer for the Augusta Heritage Center, when there's music almost every night of the week. Many of the musicians the Alley Cats have learned from play at each other's houses or at square dances in Elkins. There's Greta Fitzgibbon, who taught Nevada her first banjo tunes, and Andy Fitzgibbon and Jesse Milnes, who have been teaching Walter fiddle. Riley learned mandolin from Jeremy Wanless and Carl Smacula, whose father, Bob Smacula, sells string instruments. Nevada says she remembers the day she went to his shop to buy her current banjo.
It was really exciting, actually. It was one of the best days ever, because I went and it was like in Harry Potter, where he goes and picks out his wand. That's what it felt like, because I went and like tried out a whole bunch of different banjos, and I picked out mine.
The fiddle I have now, I got it from Bob Smacula during the Augusta Festival when he sets up his tent in the park. He brings out all of his instruments, and I sat there for probably at least two hours just playing through probably 20 or 30 different fiddles.
Although they were neighbors, the middle school band was probably where Walter and Nevada became friends. They each played the flute, and later Riley played the trumpet. The three of them also learn to arrange music and experiment with contemporary songs from a workshop they do each year at the Randolph County Arts Center called Lab Band, which is nothing like the traditional middle or high school band.
Middle school band is everybody learns instruments, and you don't get, I mean, you couldn't just take a banjo to the middle school band. You have to, there's like just, you can just pick from the ones that that are there, like flute, trumpet, the normal like orchestra instruments. And then you get sheet music and you learn to read it and you play it, and that's all. In like lab band or how we've made up our own band, we just like have, we can do like whatever we want. Lab band has been interesting because we play music with other teenagers, and it's really fun because we get to play stuff that's totally different from the normal things we play. So we've learned like Beatles songs and all kinds of like weird things, like pirate metal.
It's like electric guitars and such and loud. And Gogo Bordello is the band, and we transformed it into like our acoustic instruments and electric instruments combined, and horns and different I don't know, types of instruments, and made it the sound very similar, actually.
Last year, the Elm Street Alley Cats were invited to play in Washington, D.C. at the Hart Senate Office Building. It was just a month after their bandmate and mentor, Gene Boyer, passed away. Jerry Milne stepped in and played with them in D.C., and he's been helping the Alley Cats learn old-time tunes and help them figure out how to cover contemporary songs.
He comes to our practices sometimes and helps us work on new tunes or teaches us lyrics to old-time tunes. Jerry knows a ton about old-time music, so it's really awesome to have him helping us. I would hope that we'll start writing our own music and more. Walt's already written a song, but I hope that we can start exploring that more, writing our own music instead of just doing old-time tunes and covers of other bands.
For Allegheny Mountain Radio and Traveling 219, I'm Roxy Dodd.
That was Nevada and Riley Tribble and their neighbor Walter King of Elkins, and their band is called the Elm Street Alley Cats. You can find them on Facebook, and you can find more stories like this on traveling219.com. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.